Welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast from Canberra. I'm Michelle Grattan. Malcolm Turnbull is a former leader of the Liberal Party and always a leadership favourite with the public in opinion polls. He served in the Howard government as Environment Minister and now has one of the most difficult nitty-gritty jobs in the Abbott cabinet, that of trying to get the NBN to walk on what so far have been very shaky legs. He's also one of the few moderates in the government who actually mostly sounds like a moderate. Malcolm Turnbull, let's just start with what it's like being in the higher reaches of the Abbott government compared to the feel of the Howard government. Can you just give us some idea of the differences or indeed the similarities?
Well, Michelle, it's actually, there are many more similarities than differences, not least because a lot of us were in the Howard government. In fact, I think all of our cabinet were almost all of our cabinet were ministers in the Howard government.
Sort of old mates club.
It's not an old mates club, but there's a sense of continuity there. The main difference for me would be that Tony Abbott is much more of a peer. He's a colleague. He's, you know, roughly the same age. In fact, he's a couple of years younger than me. Whereas when I came into the Howard cabinet, you know, John Howard was this political colossus, you know, a generation older than me and obviously generations more experience in terms of politics. So that was a very different experience to the relationship I have with Tony today.
Now, turning to your portfolio, where is progress on the NBN and where do you expect it to be by the time of the next election in 2016?
Well, if the question is where is progress now, this is what we've done. We have firstly done arranged for the NBN to do, with some, you know, expert assistance from outside, a rigorous review of the project as it stands. Which of course concluded that the project under Labor specifications would end up taking nearly 4 years longer to complete and cost $73 billion, so about $30 billion more than Labor had forecast. And then also asked the question, what are the alternatives? You know, given where we are and we're not in a position to, you know, pretend it never happened and start again, which would be the ideal, but that's a fantasy. So given where we are, given the cards we've been dealt, what's the best we can do? And so the review looked at that very transparently, weighed it all up, and the recommendation is to pursue a multi-technology option. So to do a lot of fibre to the premises, use the cable networks, use the existing ones, and of course do fibre to the node, which was
your policy.
Well, it was our policy, but only, yeah, absolutely, it was our policy, but it wasn't. You've got to understand, I've never made technology an ideological issue. It's not, you know, I don't believe in fibre to the node or fibre to the premises. I mean, it's not questions of belief. The question is, you know, given a particular geography, your neighbourhood, what is the mix of technologies that will get everyone in that neighbourhood very fast broadband as soon as possible, as cheaply as possible and as affordably as possible? And let's not, you know, let's be technology agnostic. That was, I think, one of the many mistakes Labor made, turning technology into a sort of a fetish as opposed to just a tool. So we've done that. Already there have been trials on fibre to the basement, which is fibre to the node, where the node is in the basement of a apartment building, and it's already achieved, demonstrated, as we knew it would. I mean, this is not experimental technology, right? It's being deployed in millions and millions of locations around the world. But it's, you know, delivering over 100 megabits per second down, over 40 megabits per second up, so fantastic speeds and obviously at much lower cost. So the challenge now is we've got some renegotiations with Telstra over the terms of the agreements to get access to the legacy assets and then to deploy it and then obviously make those choices about which technology to use. But that's all moving ahead. The fibre to the premises rollout is continuing, and it's continue because we obviously want to, we don't want to, you know, down tools or anything like that. and it is continuing at a significantly faster rate than it was under the previous government. So for those people who say that, you know, the Abbott government has stopped the broadband rollout, it's completely untrue. If anything, we've accelerated it.
So by 2016, what proportion of households will have fast broadband?
Well, the estimate in the strategic review is that by 2016, 43% of the fixed line footprint, which is about 93% of all premises, will have access to 25 megabits per second or more. And by 2019, over 90% will have access to 50 megabits per second or more. And of that 91%, between 65 and 75% will have access to 100 megs or more. And of course, the remaining 7% will be covered by the satellite and fixed wireless, which should run at 25 megs. So the project, it will certainly be complete a lot sooner than doing fibre everywhere. But you know, the big difference is the time is one difference. The big difference is the money, Michelle. I mean, the point I was just making in the House a moment ago is a very important one. I mean, you know, and this is where there is a kind of almost a dysfunctionality in the Labor Party's appreciation of this. They seem to think that you can establish a government monopoly, overcapitalise it, but it won't result in higher prices. I mean, it's obvious. If you build a telecom government monopoly telecommunications network, and you have peak funding requirement of $73 billion. That is, as opposed to $41 billion under the approach we're talking about, that is going to result in much higher prices. It has to, because there's 32.
So what is the example of that?
Well, the example of that is that the strategic review concluded, and this was not written by me or the government. This was done by the NBN independently. That conclusion was that under Labor's plan, internet prices, average internet prices for consumers, would be up to 80% higher, and because of the increased, capital investment. So, you know, that's the thing you've got to triage, isn't it? You've got to sort of triangulate, I should say. You've got to triangulate cost, how much is this going to cost me? Time, how long is it going to take me to do it? And at the end of the day, is anyone going to be able to afford to pay for it? So, you know, if you don't care about cost and time, you can build the most amazing network, fibre everywhere, and you know, gold plate it to the nth degree. Problem is, no one will be able to pay for it, and so it's pointless.
Now, just turning to another area of your portfolio, which has been in the news, obviously, continually, and that's the ABC. You've not been uncritical of the ABC, but you're seen as one of its few friends within the government. I can understand why Liberals might have some criticism of the broadcaster, but it's a bit hard to understand why there's such deep passion among Conservatives on your side about the ABC. Can you explain this?
Well, look, you've really got to talk to them. You know, I think the ABC...
I'm sure they do talk to you.
Well, they do, but look, let me make a couple of observations about the ABC. The ABC is a public broadcaster. It's using taxpayers' money. It should do so as cost-effectively as possible. And I'm very committed to the ABC being run as efficiently as possible, and that's why we've got, for the first time, an efficiency review being done. It's one of the things that's got nothing to do with politics. It's like a housekeeping thing for me. I'm the new minister, so we're doing an efficiency review of the ABC and SBS to ascertain, you know, what are the most cost-effective ways? Are there more cost-effective ways for them to do their job? Not telling them what types of dramas to put on, or, you know, who should be the host of Q&A, or, you know, what the political journalist should say, but just, you know, in terms of running the business, could it be done more efficiently? That's one thing. In the other thing is that the ABC has a bargain. It's a bargain that is in statute, it's the law of the land. And the bargain is this, that the ABC has to deliver, in return for all the taxpayers' money, you know, about, you know, one well over $1 billion a year, it's got to deliver news and information which is impartial, That's the words of the Act. Accurate, objective. So that's their obligation. Now, a lot of people seem to think that because I'm the communications minister, it's my job to make them do that. But I'm the communications minister, I'm not the editor-in-chief. The control of the ABC is vested in its board of directors. And under Section 8 of the Act, they have the obligation to ensure that it complies with its charter and indeed with those requirements of accuracy and impartiality. So it's very, it is, you know, now people may say, well, you know, perhaps there are too many Labor people on the board. Well, all I can say is that the board of the ABC from 2001 to 2008, apart from the staff elected director, all of its directors, eight in number, had been appointed by the Howard government. So there's 8 years. In fact, in 2000, there was a majority of Howard government appointees. So the board has always had the control of that company. It can hire and fire the managing director and tell him, give him directions as to how to do his job. So that's really where, and you know, the alternative is, what's the alternative? I become the editor-in-chief, I become the executive director of the 7:30 report, or Tony Abbott does. It's ridiculous. You know, the fact is, if you're going to have a public broadcaster, it has to be independent. It has to have independence vested in a board. But what the board has to do is to make sure that it is strictly impartial. And you see, this gets us to its position vis-a-vis the other media. Whether it is the Telegraph and the Australian, or the Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, or the Finn Review, or the Guardian, or, you know, Mumbrella, or whoever, anyone in the private media can be as partisan as they like. They can be utterly unreasonably partisan. They can be horribly biased. They can be absurdly biased. They can be unfair. Of course, they've got to bear in mind the laws of defamation, but apart from that, they can say what they like because they're independent. The ABC can't. And it's absolutely critical that everyone understands that the ABC is different. It's special. It's special because of its role as the national broadcaster, as a public broadcaster. And the same comments, of course, apply to SBS. So, you know, there's some people who say, well, you know, the Murdoch press veers to the right, therefore shouldn't the ABC balance that by veering to the left? Wrong. That's absolutely wrong. The ABC has to go straight down the centre. It doesn't matter which way the private media, the commercial media is going. That's irrelevant. The ABC has to be, in terms of its impartiality and objectivity, more like a judge. It's got to play it down the middle. That's the law. And the board has the responsibility, the heavy responsibility, to ensure that that happens.
Of course, objectivity is often in the eyes of the beholder, and it's not that easy to achieve, even for judges.
I agree with that. I agree. I'm not suggesting it's easy, but it is.
It's a goal rather than an actual thing.
But you know something? It's a funny thing, Michelle. I think objectivity in reporting is a bit like daytime and nighttime. Most of the time, it's perfectly obvious whether it's day or night. And there's maybe 10 minutes at the beginning and the end of the day when it's arguable whether it's day or night. So I agree there are hard cases, but most of the time it's pretty clear. And I think that's there will always be hard cases and people will disagree. But I think the critical thing, the ABC board, management, reporters have to recognise they are different. If they want to write, you know, if they want to have the freedom to, you know, editorialise and opinionate and so forth that they do in the commercial media, then they should go and work in the commercial media. They are in a special capacity at the ABC.
Now, you mentioned News Limited a moment ago, and at the weekend when you were launching the new Saturday paper, you made some remarks, off-the-cuff remarks in your speech about News Limited, and I noticed on your blog you were very quick to say that your reference to a demented plutocrat was certainly not referring to Rupert Murdoch. But nevertheless, you
had. I'm not sure that anyone in the room thought it was, but it was. There was that sort of inference on the insiders program. I think David Marr was being characteristically mischievous, and so I just wanted to put that to rest. But I'll explain that the context was this: was that over the years, many rich men who have made their, I think they've all been men, who have made their money in some other area. You know, William Randolph Hearst famously had the Comstock Silver Lode, and there's numerous other examples. You know, Sheldon Adelson made his money in casinos and, you know, then invested in newspapers. And yes, there's tons and tons of people that have done this, and they're perfectly entitled to do this. And the suggestion has been that Maurice Schwartz, who is a property developer and obviously made his money, you know, in property, I guess, in the suggestion was that, you know, he was just another rich guy.
Founder of this paper.
Yeah, founder of the Saturday paper and the quarterly essay and the monthly was, you know, on this sort of vainglorious vanity publishing frolic, not caring about the losses, just to, you know, put his own political views out there. And the only point I made was that Maurie is not, while he has certainly got, he is a political radical, he's definitely of the left, although he says his paper will steer down the centre, but I think it'll veer to the left more often than not. but the point is that he's certainly claims, and I've no reason to doubt him, that the Quarterly Essay and the Monthly, which I think have been important niche publications, do make a profit or, you know, cover their costs. So he's not. So and I was just that was the only point I was making, and the suggestion. I mean, I'm surprised to see some people who work for Rupert Murdoch suggesting I was referring to Murdoch because they obviously don't understand or failing to reflect on Rupert's history. Because Rupert, far from being a person who'd made his fortune in something else and then decided, you know, later in his career to go into publishing, as you know, inherited his father's pretty battered around afternoon newspaper when he was barely out of his teens, and then built it up, and he actually made his fortune in newspapers. So he's, while I'm sure, you know, not all of his publications have always made as much money as the others, as a group, his newspapers have been extremely profitable, remain profitable. And so he's not a William Randolph Hearst or a, you know, Marvin Adelson or a Jimmy Goldsmith or a Conrad Black. I mean, it's a long list.
You know. Nevertheless, you did have a couple of cheeky little humorous digs at The Australian and...
We're not allowed to have a joke? Is that his humour being
abolished? I think that might
be
the case because Chris Mitchell, the editor-in-chief of The Australian, has now said Malcolm cannot resist seeking approval from his party's enemies.
Well, I don't have a dystopian view of the world. I don't go around thinking, you know, saying, here are my enemies, here are my friends. You know, I as I said just a minute ago in the House, I'm the Minister for Communications. I'm not the Minister for right-wing communications. I'm not the Minister for persecuting the media that disagrees with me and favouring the media that agrees with me. I'm the Minister for, as far as it comes to the media, ensuring that we have the freest media scene we can, the most diverse media we can, and I welcome new publications. And I think, you know, this is the internet's posed, as we all know, some terrible problems for established newspapers, but it's also created the opportunity for so much competition. I mean, look what we're doing. This podcast wouldn't have been possible without the internet. The conversation wouldn't be possible without the internet, and so many other publications. So we're in a very exciting time. And that's, you know, that's the big difference between me as communications minister and Stephen Conroy, because Conroy saw the arrival of the internet as an opportunity to have more regulation and less freedom. And my view is the internet is creating the most competitive media environment we've had in my lifetime, and it's getting more competitive, and so it actually makes the case for less regulation and more freedom. So you couldn't get a starker difference. So I think those people who say, oh, you know, Malcolm Turnbull shouldn't, you know, darken the door of any publication that doesn't absolutely sing the praises of the Liberal Party day in, day out are missing the point. You know, we've all got a vested interest in freedom. You know, the person with the right-wing opinions has a vested interest in the person with the left-wing opinions being able to express them. Now, look, this is so basic, you wouldn't think you needed to explain it, but it is fundamental, and this is a core value for me and for the Liberal Party and for the government, and it's a value of freedom.
And do you think this is sometimes underestimated by your colleagues?
I don't think so. I think having just expressed those views in the House, I passed three or four colleagues on the way back here, and each of them said they agreed with exactly what I'd said, and they came from different wings of the party. So I dividing the world up between enemies and friends is a bleak old world, isn't it?
A lot of grey between often.
Well, that's right, and the point is, I'm not the minister for right-wing communications. Stephen Conroy may well have been the minister for left-wing communications. I'm the minister for communications. I'm the minister in favour of all of the media being free. I'm the minister that welcomes you having your point of view and the Guardian having its point of view and the Australian having its point of view and Quadrant having its point of view and go right around the spectrum. The more the merrier. That's democracy.
Well, just before we leave the whole freedom thing, of course, this is quite a big agenda for the government, and there's an interesting debate going on within the Human Rights Commission about the Racial Discrimination Act and whether that should be changed, especially in the wake of the legal action against Andrew Bolt, who was found in breach because of his aspersions on fair-skinned Aborigines. One commissioner says it should go entirely. Another commissioner says that it's been very valuable and you meddle really at your peril. Do you have a view on that?
Look, it's become a very technical debate, very technical discussion. I am a lawyer, as you know, retired lawyer, long distance from the courts. But it's very much in George Brandis's area. I talk to him about it occasionally. We're both very committed to free speech equally. We don't want to, you know, we've got very strong views about hate speech and speech which vilifies people on the basis of their race. So, there are some real questions, I think, about the language of the section. And
There's only been one case that's been a problem, though.
No, there's one case that has been controversial, and George is, in his characteristically elegant way, seeking to craft amendments which will preserve and enhance free speech without enabling, race vilification speech of the kind we deplore. But beyond that, Michelle, you should talk to him. He will give you probably more detail than you'd like. he's very learned.
Well, on another free speech area within your portfolio, the government plans to give parents more control over what their children have access to on the internet.
Only in the sense of making sure they've got software to, you know, that they can use. Parents have complete control. Well, they have complete legal control over what their children do online. And one of the great mistakes the previous government made was with this proposal for the great big internet filter, which was so unpopular and so unworkable. And I think so counterproductive at many levels, because it would have created the impression that parents could say, I don't have to worry about what little Johnny's doing online because the government's looking after it. Well, there is no substitute for knowing what your kids are doing and making it your business to know what they're doing. That's your responsibility as a parent. So I don't think we're not adding to parents' rights. What we are doing is seeking to, what we're proposing to do is establish a Children's E-Safety Commissioner, which is really just a means of providing a more rapid, ensuring that there is a more rapid response for the big social media platforms to take down material which is, you know, can be described as harassing or bullying. You know, we've got a discussion paper out on the moment. There's at the moment there's obviously, you know, a degree of consultation going on, but the, you know, the idea is to just make the system work a bit better.
So you don't see any freedom of speech issues here?
Well, not, no. I mean, I think, you know, I don't think there's, I don't think we would feel, you know, if you know, there is a, say, a, you know, an online campaign to bully a 15-year-old girl and humiliate a 15-year-old girl online by some of her, you know, not terribly charitable or thoughtful associates. I think if we've got a means to quickly bring that to an end, I don't think that's really a First Amendment issue, do you?
No, indeed. Now, on another topic, Labor's Deputy Leader Tanya Plibersek is trying to get a Liberal to partner her for a bill to legalise gay marriage. Now, you've spoken out strongly in favour of gay marriage in the past. We know your views. We also know, of course, that you can't be part of that sort of campaign given your position. But do you hope that she does get someone in your party to sponsor, co-sponsor that bill, and do you think she has any chance of doing
so? I don't know. I think she's probably got a good chance. I mean, I, you know, she's asked me, and obviously I can't. If I was on the back bench, I probably would, but I can't as a member of the executive. But I think we should legalise same-sex marriage. I think it will, you know, the standard procedure would be for a private member's bill to come up. But that's obviously can't be moved by a member of the executive, which is a government member on the front bench, as it were. So we'll see. I mean, she can. She doesn't necessarily, you know, she could have two Labor members or Labor and an independent. I mean, maybe she could ask Clive to support it. But it's. But the issue really, there are two issues. Then is will we have a free vote in the coalition party room or the Liberal Party room? And I've said publicly I think we should, and everyone knows my views on that. And if we do, then all other things being equal and the, you know, the bill being sensible and conventional, I would I'd vote in favour of it. So my view, I mean, I've been very clear about that, and I I might say that when I ran for re-election in the last elections, I made my position absolutely crystal clear in all of the literature I sent out to, or, you know, in the literature I sent out to my electorate.
And
so everyone who voted in Wentworth knows exactly where I stand on this.
And do you think if there was a free vote in the current circumstances, it probably would pass?
Michelle, I haven't done the numbers. That's more your line of work, I think.
I'm not a very good counter. I'm sure you're a better one.
Well, I'm not sure. I've had a mixed record with ballots. But the
always be a little bit out. You know?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's my view was in the last Parliament, a conscience vote would not have seen a majority in the House of Representatives. I think it's much more likely. I haven't done any head counting. The only reason I'd say it's much more likely is that the debate has moved on so rapidly. I mean, since we were last talking about this 18 months or so ago, you know, the UK has legalised same-sex marriage. The French have legalised it. The New Zealanders have legalised it. So you're in a position now, and of course numerous states in America have. So you're in a position now where about a third of Americans live in jurisdictions where same-sex marriage is legal. And the general view in America that it is inevitable sooner or later that the US Supreme Court will say it's constitutionally protected, at which case it's all over. But, you know, so you same-sex couples can get married in the East Coast and the West Coast, and there's quite a few places where they can't, but you know, there's about 100 million, I think, roughly, Americans live in states where they can do it. Obviously, the Canadians can, the British can, the New Zealanders can, the South Africans can. You know, we are the only big English-speaking country where gay marriage is not lawful, to my knowledge, where it is not lawful anywhere.
Do you think if this bill came before the House and there was a free vote in the Liberal Party, Tony Abbott would behave like John Howard did in the Constitutional Republic referendum, or do you think he'd just let let the cards fall where they would?
I really think you'd have to talk to Tony about that. I mean, he's got a personal view.
But would he campaign within
that's something, you know, you would...
Pretty important question.
It is an important question, but it's an important question for him.
What's your instinct?
I honestly don't know. I'd just be wildly speculating, which would no doubt be interesting, but it wouldn't be informative.
But just to sum up this this topic, you would encourage some Liberal to join with Tanya Plibersek to sponsor this?
No, campaign. I'm not. No, I haven't said I would encourage a Liberal to do that.
But you would hope that perhaps someone
comes forward. Well, I think it. I'm not going to give people advice on it. I certainly think these things are better off moved in a bipartisan way, but it is a matter for the, you know, relevant private, you know, backbenchers concerned.
And they wouldn't be ostracised.
I I'm absolutely certain. I mean, there is a variety of views in the party about gay marriage, and I can tell you there are a lot of very prominent Liberals, not least of whom is Tony's sister, Chris Foster, who's, you know, is a councillor of the City of Sydney, who are very prominent advocates of gay marriage. And I mean, you know, Chris lives with her partner and, you know, in a de facto relationship, and they'd like to get married. And she's a very eloquent, you know, given the pedigree, as you can imagine, she's a very persuasive person. So whether she's been able to persuade her brother, time will tell.
Malcolm Turnbull, thank you very much for talking with us. That's all today from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thanks to my producer, Matt Dawson, and see you next time.
Thanks, Michelle.